Today's interview is going to enlighten you with concepts that I bet many of you have never heard before. There are so many Western diseases that plague us, everything from heart disease to cancers to dementias, and there's mounting evidence that a switch is responsible, a biological survival switch is responsible for excessive fat storage and is at the root cause of major diseases which are endemic in the Western world. In the interview today, we are going to talk about what you can do to turn off your survival switch and stop fostering disease. We're going to talk about what humans have in common with hibernating bears and sperm whales and the world's fattest birds. And we're going to take a major shift in our perspective because we're going to discuss why fructose and not glucose is what drives insulin resistance and metabolic disease. The foods that we're eating are triggering our bodies to make its own fructose, and it's at the root of what is causing so much fat accumulation. We're going to talk about how important salt and dehydration plays in the accumulation of fat and clearly delineate what is the relationship between the survival switch and health conditions that span everything from gout to kidney disease to liver disease to stroke to behavioral disorders, including addiction and ADHD. And we're going to make it simple. And we're going to talk through how to take this pioneering research to not only prevent and reduce obesity, but to lower our overall risk of developing disease. This is The Lindsay Elmore Show. Welcome to The Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast for people who deserve to be healthy, with honest, open, and enlightening conversations with doctors, thought leaders, creatives, and spiritual gurus. You'll walk away with simple and tangible tips and tricks that allow you to live your healthiest life so you can pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark. Dr. Richard Johnson is a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado and is a clinician, educator, and researcher. He is board certified in internal medicine, infectious disease, and kidney disease, and is the founding editor of Comprehensive Clinical Nephrology, one of the main textbooks on kidney disease. For more than 20 years, he has led research on the causes of obesity and diabetes, with a special interest in the role of sugar, especially fructose, and uric acid. His research has been highly cited, published in top medical journals, and supported by grants from the National Institute of Health. He is the author of The Sugar Fix, The Fat Switch, and Nature Wants Us to Be Fat. He lives in Colorado with his wife, kids, and two rambunctious puppies. Dr. Richard Johnson, welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
I am delighted to be on your show, Lindsay.
The name of your book is frankly horrifying, Nature Wants Us to Be Fat, because it is so true. We have talked with exercise specialists who say, you know, your body really doesn't want you to exercise. And when we are exposed to so many just deeply satisfying, fatty, salty, sweet foods that just trigger that biology in us. We talked with Joan Ifland just about how pervasive processed food addiction is and how it truly disrupts our brain. And in your book, you talk about how many major of the, you know, most of the endemic diseases of the Western world, heart disease, cancer, and dementia, are simply because we're fighting against our own nature. So talk to us a little bit first about What is the biological switch that drives obesity?
Absolutely. So I'm a researcher. As you know, I've been working, trying to study obesity and diabetes for almost 25, 30 years. And in the process of our research, we became aware that animals, although they often regulate their weight very tightly, there's times when they will trigger a biologic change where suddenly they become very hungry and they start eating a lot more food, and they, instead of normally regulating their weight in a very tight range, they kind of lose control and they just start increasing weight on a daily basis, accumulating a huge amount of fat, and it's all with a purpose. That purpose is to help them survive a period of time when there's no food, such as when they're nesting for several months, or when they are migrating long distances, or when they are hibernating. And this process where you suddenly become hungry, and then instead of regulating your weight tightly, you start increasing your weight dramatically, is actually a whole, like a switch. And it isn't just accumulating fat. So it's also, they become insulin resistant and they raise their blood pressure and they increase the fats in their blood and in their liver. And it's a whole orchestrated event. And what's kind of cool is it turns out that this is actually triggered. It's a biologic process that can be triggered by certain foods. And it's not triggered by all foods. It's triggered primarily by fructose, which is the sugar in fruit and honey. And it's also the sugar, fructose is present in table sugar and in a high fructose corn syrup. And for us, most of our exposure to fructose comes from these added sugars like high fructose corn syrup and table sugar, which are added not just to desserts and, you know, they're not just present in desserts and soft drinks, but they're often present in processed foods. And so what we really kind of characterized was that there is this switch, and we actually figured out how it worked, what, you know, the actual mechanism. And then we had this terrible surprise where we found that the body can make fructose, and it does so in response to other foods. So it's not just the sugar we eat or the fructose we eat, but it's the fructose we make. And that whole story started to kind of link into the fact that today, most of us are eating a lot of foods that actually activate this biologic switch that makes us want to gain weight. And mm-hmm. this is playing a big role in why we're obese. You know, for years, people said, well, it's the reason we're getting overweight is because we just are picking wrong foods. We're eating too much. We're getting big plates of food. We're going back for seconds. We're not exercising enough. And there's some truth to that, but it isn't because it's our choice. It's because we've activated a biologic process where we're still hungry if we eat a small plate of food. We're still, you know, we decrease our energy metabolism so that, you know, because we activate the switch. So we're sitting watching TV because we're more comfortable that way because we've actually reduced our energy metabolism. So it's really an amazing switch. And it also has another side to it, which is even if you don't eat extra food, the switch will still inside your body make you pre-diabetic and all this stuff. So there's a calorie independent aspect to this pathway. So it's something we don't want to activate because it can lead to not just obesity, but things like diabetes and other conditions. So this is what I've been studying for many years and publishing And so I thought I should put it into a book, tell people about this because it's so relevant to trying to stay healthy and keep a, slim figure.
Absolutely. So I have a feeling some of our listeners are like so confused because when it comes to diabetes, it's all about monitoring glucose and how much of your hemoglobin is glycosylated. But what you're saying is that it's not really a glucose problem, it's a fructose problem.
Well, it's sort of both. So, Lindsay, you're absolutely right. So let's dive into this if it's okay. So there are two main carbohydrates, two main simple sugars. One is fructose, which is in honey and fruit, and we think of this as healthy. And then there's glucose, which is the main carbohydrate that floats around in our blood. And when glucose is too low, we call it hypoglycemia, and you're kind of like lightheaded. And if your glucose is too high, we start calling it insulin resistance. And then if it's too high, we call it diabetes. And so naturally, we kind of focus on glucose because, and a classic hypothesis is that obesity is from eating foods that are high in glucose. And when you eat these high glycemic carbs like rice and potatoes and bread that have a lot of starch in them, they're broken down to glucose, and the glucose goes up in your blood and it triggers this hormone called insulin. And insulin moves the glucose into our tissues and produces fat. So when you think of it that way, you say, aha, glucose is the problem. And our work sort of put a wrench into that. Kind of because it turns out that it's the glucose is not as big an issue as the fructose is. And the way it works is as follows. So it's fructose that triggers the switch, okay? And when animals eat fructose in the wild, they're eating huge amounts of fruit. They're not eating the natural fruits that we eat, the one or two fruits, at a setting. They're eating, hundreds or even thousands of grapes, for example. A bear will eat lots of grapes and berries, and they eat so much sugar that or fruit that contains this fructose that they trigger this switch big time. And when we eat a natural fruit, which has like 5 grams of fructose, we actually inactivate the first 5 grams in our intestine, and so we don't actually get a lot of fructose from a single fruit. But if we take a lot of fruits and make a fruit juice, we can get a big dose of fructose. But when it comes to things like bread and rice, which we know are not, they're also not healthy, right? We know that if you eat a lot of bread or rice and so forth, that it can cause obesity. And so the thinking was it was this glucose insulin pathway. But what we found is that there is a system in the body that makes fructose. And that system, I call it the polyol pathway because that's the name for it, the chemical name for it. But it's a series two reactions. It's a chemical reaction in which glucose gets converted to fructose. And it actually is glucose is converted to sorbitol. And then sorbitol is converted to fructose. So your body can make fructose, but it makes it from glucose, okay? So when you eat bread and rice and potatoes and things like that, the glucose levels go up in your liver and they go up in your blood. And insulin is triggered. And so this process that we've been talking about, that a lot of people talk about, is going on. But when the glucose goes up in the blood, it also triggers this polyol pathway to convert the glucose to fructose. And you can show it in people, but you can really do it well by studying laboratory animals. And what we did is we gave glucose to animals, like a high glycemic diet, like giving them rice, and they started to make fructose in their body. And the way we know that the fructose is what made them fat was because we can block, we can give this to an animal that cannot metabolize fructose, but can still have a good insulin system. Mm-hmm. And so when we did that, we could really knock down, we could prevent diabetes from developing, we could prevent fatty liver, and we could reduce the amount of fat. There was still a little bit of fat that accumulated, but it reduced it a lot. So we think the insulin pathway is important, but there's another trick, and that is when you're eating high glycemic carbs, like rice, potatoes, bread, chips, cereal, things that when you eat, they release a lot of glucose. Some of that glucose is being converted to fructose, and it's actually that fructose that's driving the whole problem, and so or much of the problem. And so to get back to your comment, yeah, no, bread and rice and potatoes, they're not, you know, you don't want to eat a lot of those because they can cause obesity. And so glucose is important. It can cause obesity, but it does so not in a direct way, but because it stimulates the production of fructose. Mm. And so fructose is the actual activator of the switch.
Very, very interesting. So, you know, how do we turn this switch off? And do we want it off 100% of the time? Or do we have something in common with hibernating bears where maybe we need a little bit of extra body weight in the winter and a little bit less in the summer?
Well, so it turns out that humans, that's us, we're very, very sensitive to the effects of fructose. And we're more sensitive than most animals. And the reason turns out to be related to our genetics. And it turns out that the way fructose triggers this switch is through a substance called uric acid. And this substance is present in everybody. We all have it. You can measure it in your blood. And the levels can vary. They can vary quite a bit. So certain foods tend to raise uric acid. And one of them is fructose. So when you eat fructose, it raises uric acid. And our group showed that when the uric acid was being produced from the fructose, that it actually played a role in triggering the biologic switch. So it's important in how fructose wants to make you become hungry, for example. Mm-hmm. So what happened is that humans have higher uric acids in general than most other animals. And so although the levels vary between people, it also, in general, the uric acid levels are higher in us. And when we eat fructose, we generate a higher uric acid response. And so that higher response leads to a more powerful effect of sugar. So if you give a teaspoon of sugar to a mouse based on its, you know, correcting it for its weight, of course, and you gave that same dose to us, we would be more likely to show an effect than the mouse. And the reason is because we have higher uric acids. And the reason we have the high uric acids turns out to be from our past. And there was a time in our past when our species was endangered from starvation. And I've done a lot of work with this with some anthropologists and archaeologists. And we actually, you know, figured out when the genetic mutation occurred. But, you know, I didn't figure it out, but my collaborators did. And we even resurrected the extinct genes that regulate uric acid and showed, you know, that when we underwent a mutation in this, it actually had an effect to make us more sensitive to sugar and or to fructose. And what happened was that mutation helped us survive way back when. And so it helped us store fat more effectively during a time when there was no food. And it helped us. But today, that same mutation, coupled with all the sugar and foods that can make fructose that we're eating, that combination is why why things are bad for us. And so, you know, the biologic switch was meant to be a good guy. It's meant to help us when we're starving and when we need, when we're in trouble. But for the most of us, we're not in trouble right now, from at least from starving. And now our problem is that we're eating a lot of these foods that trigger this switch, and we are overly sensitive to the effects of sugar. Mm-hmm. You know, in 1700, the average person was eating about 4 pounds of sugar a year. And in 1800, it was like 18 pounds of sugar a year. And, you know, studies in the 1990s and around 2000 showed that people were eating like 150 pounds of sugar, you know, a year. That's unbelievable increase. And so when you have that huge increase in sugar, which, and remember, table sugar, half of it is fructose. You know, we're getting a large exposure to fructose. And then when they made the sweetener, high fructose corn syrup, you know, it was liquid, it was easy to mix into food, and you could put just even a tiny bit could make the food, you know, just a slightly bit sweet, and people kind of like that, and you wouldn't even notice that it's sweet. You know, like, for example, like a cracker, there, you know, the cracker that's called a Wheat Thin, they're delicious, and it's got just a tiny bit of high fructose corn syrup in it to really make it taste very delicious without you really recognizing that there's like a lot of sugar in there. Mm-hmm. And so this high fructose corn syrup was added to a lot of foods, and in general we like the taste, and we're very sensitive to the effects of sugar because of this mutation we had. And the result is that it's having an effect where it's making us hungry, and we eat more than we normally do, and so that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so interesting, all of these ancient mechanisms that we have that are intended to help protect us. And, you know, you mentioned this glucose, fructose, uric acid pathway that's there to protect us. We have talked so much on the show about the sympathetic versus parasympathetic nervous system and the amygdala and all of the ancient structures in the limbic system that are there to help protect us, but it's just there are no lions running at us anymore. We're not starving on a daily basis. And as we discussed with Dr. Ifland, another thing about adding just that tiny, tiny amount of sugar is that it makes the food so much more hyper palatable. I mean, there is sugar in hamburgers. There is sugar that is added. You know, you're sitting here saying don't eat white potatoes, but I mean, you look at French fries from a regular old fast food place, it's got sugar added to it on top of all the naturally occurring fructose. And so I'd like to dive more into uric acid because I feel like this is a very new and emerging understanding of how the body works, how uric acid can play a role in aging, in obesity, in the development of heart disease. I mean, this was something that nobody talked about up until very, very recently. And now uric acid is not only being shown to be a part of regulating molecular signals and regulating inflammation and oxidative stress, but there's even research going into can drugs that prevent the formation of uric acid cause positive health outcomes in people who have heart failure or coronary heart disease or type 2 diabetes. So before we get to the rest of my interview, let's take a break for a word from our sponsors. Eaton Hemp is a farmer-owned hemp company located in upstate New York, and they focus on using all of the powerful benefits of hemp to create superfood products. They offer delicious and nutritious farm-to-table certified USDA organic hemp food products, including toasted hemp seeds and hemp hearts, and they have these amazing tasty hemp balls that are going to be your new addiction. You can add their tasty hemp products to just about anything from smoothies, salads, or your favorite healthy recipe. Not only do they boost the flavor, but they add a punch of protein and fiber, as well as an omega-3 fatty acid boost, and are loaded with micronutrients like magnesium, zinc, and iron. They are considered to be the nature's most nutrient-dense superfood. As a special offer for our podcast listeners, you can save 25% on all Eaton Hemp products and still get a full money-back guarantee. Head over to www.eatonhemp.com/Lindsay Elmore Show to save 25% on all of your new favorite snacks. That's www.eatonhemp.com/Lindsay Elmore Show. Please be sure to shop the code provided so that Eaton Hemp knows that the show sent you to them. And now, let's get back to the show. Take us back to the beginning. Help us to understand, where did this uric acid research kind of start? And what do we know now about just how important uric acid is in our healthy aging processes?
Well, you're talking to the guy who probably has done more studies on uric acid than just about anybody else.
That's why I asked you. I got the best of the best here.
So let's just go over it. So uric acid is a nitrogen-containing substance that circulates in our blood. And it's made from things like when energy is broken down, when energy is broken down, it generates uric acid. And also it's like broken down from things like RNA and DNA. So just as there's, protein, carbohydrates, and fats, there's also what we call nucleic acids. This is another thing, and nucleotides. And these are substances that make up our nucleus, our DNA, our RNA, and our energy. And when they break down, they form uric acid. Now, uric acid can also be formed from by eating foods that contain DNA and RNA and energy products. So things what we call like high purine foods purines are kind of a name for these nitrogen substances that can break down to form uric acid. And when uric acid was originally discovered, it was thought to, it was recognized that it was a substance that is in our blood, but if the substance gets to too high a concentration, it can crystallize. And it can form kidney stones, for example, but it can also crystallize in the joints. And when it does, it causes an arthritis, really painful, pain in your joints where you get red hot tender joints. And it's from urate crystals that precipitate into your joints. And so that's called gout. And about 9 million people have gout in the U.S. It's not a small number. And it presents as this painful arthritis. You go on some medicine to, an anti-inflammatory drugs, and then the pain goes away. And oftentimes people go back to how they were feeling, and they don't realize that, that the gout is sort of a sign that the uric acid is high in their blood. But for a long, long time, it was noted that people with high uric acid often tend to be overweight, like maybe 2/3 of them, that they tend to have this metabolic syndrome, maybe 80% of them. that they tend to develop heart disease, maybe 75% of them. That they get kidney disease, well, almost 95% of them at autopsy will show kidney disease, and 50% of patients with gout will have kidney disease that's actively known. And other things like high blood pressure is associated with it. So gout got early on got associated with being overweight, having diabetes, having hypertension, and so forth. But it was always sort of thought that, you know, gout's from eating really rich foods and drinking too much alcohol and eating the, you know, shrimp and lobster and all these things that we shouldn't be eating so much of, and so forth. But it was known for a long time, too, that sugar could precipitate gout, and it was because of the fructose. And so that was also known. So it was that sugar, alcohol, these high-purine foods. And it was thought that, you know, gout was just another manifestation of a bad diet, and that, you know, that the gout itself wasn't having a role in causing the obesity or diabetes, it was just an accompaniment. And yours truly, in like 1999, a long time ago, became curious about uric acid and kidney disease and high blood pressure. And I was really knew that high uric acid was so commonly associated with high blood pressure. And I thought to myself, could it be that some of these uric acid, you know, could it be that it might crystallize into the kidneys? And if it did, maybe it would cause the kidney some inflammation and prevent the kidneys from getting rid of salt very well. And, you know, it was kind of a jump, but I thought maybe if there was low-grade inflammation, it would affect the excretion of sodium or salt. And it was known that salt had a role in blood pressure. And I said, well, maybe that's the way it works, that gout could actually cause high blood pressure. And, you know, this was sort of like thinking outside the box a little bit. You know, most people were not thinking this way. But I mentioned that humans have higher uric acid levels, and it's because they had lost this enzyme called uricase, and this enzyme normally degrades uric acid. So most animals, like if you look at a mouse, it has a low uric acid. So I thought, well, I'm just going to block that uricase and raise its uric acid and see what happens. And when we blocked it and the uric acid went up, the animals developed hypertension. And I remember Marilda Mazzali, my fellow, coming to me and saying, Rick, you won't believe it. These rats have become hypertensive. I said, it can't be true. I mean, if uric acid caused high blood pressure, wouldn't the world know it? And she says they're all hypertensive. So I had her do like 100 animals before I believed the data. And then we, you know, lowered the uric acid and the blood pressure came down. And, you know, it was no good. No matter how I tried to make it not be true, it was true. And so we realized that uric acid was causing high blood pressure. So then we looked in the kidneys thinking we're going to see crystals, but there weren't any crystals. So then we said, oh my gosh, how is the uric acid doing this? And then we realized that uric acid actually has all these biologic effects, even when it's soluble. And so when it's circulating in our blood, it has a lot of biologic effects. And so then there was I had moved to Houston. I was working at Baylor, and there's pediatrician came to see me, a pediatric kidney specialist, and he was running a clinic with overweight adolescents who had just been diagnosed with high blood pressure. And I said, you know, we found this link with uric acid and blood pressure. And I said, you know, do you want to look at it in your children? And he came back about 2 months later and says, you won't believe it, but just about every kid who's got high blood pressure has a high uric acid. And the relationship between the blood pressure and the uric acid is like a line. It's linear. So he ended up with me writing a grant to do research to actually lower the uric acid in these adolescents. And when he did, with a medication, and it was a very double-blind crossover, you know, all these careful controls, and we found that if we lowered the blood uric acid, we lowered the blood pressure in 90% of these children.
It's so fascinating because one of the major downfalls of Western medicine and modern medicine in general is trying to piecemeal the body and just go like uric acid, that means gout. You know, when it's like, as you're saying, uric acid has a ton of different roles and responsibilities in the body. And it's so fascinating to think of a linear relationship between the levels of uric acid and the degree of hypertension. And so, all right, so you mentioned these high purine foods, which, you know, if you go to your favorite search engine and just look up some of the historical artwork that looks like gout, it's always the very gluttonous man with the big belly drinking the huge pitcher of beer. But it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, you're kind of saying like maybe the high purine foods aren't really the problem. If somebody is listening today and they're like, you know what, I've got high blood pressure, I've got diabetes, I've tried so much else, maybe it's uric acid. How do you recommend that people begin to approach managing uric acid levels?
So, when we originally did this, we just raised the uric acid by blocking the enzyme. And then we started looking at which foods were really responsible. And we found that fructose was a major player, that it could raise the uric acid, it could raise the blood pressure and so forth. And so fructose became a big player. And so we started looking at table sugar as a major source. But we've also looked at other foods as well. And it turns out that I probably should just mention one other thing, is that when we gave the fruit, you know, so when we found that uric acid was driving blood pressure, we then did other studies and showed that it happened, it's most important in early high blood pressure, because what happens is in the early stages, the kidneys are completely normal. And when you raise the uric acid, you get this high blood pressure response. But over time, you do get kidney injury. And once there's sufficient kidney injury, the blood pressure is driven by the kidney. So it was the initiator, not totally responsible for all of hypertension. Okay, so it got in. So like if you're an adolescent just diagnosed with high blood pressure, you're going to be more likely to respond to lowering the uric acid to helping your blood pressure than if you have had high blood pressure for 20 years. Okay. And then we said to ourselves, okay, well, if this uric acid is playing a role in high blood pressure, we know that sugar, fructose, raises uric acid, and we knew that fructose could raise blood pressure. So we said, well, let's do that. So we gave fructose to animals. They developed high blood pressure. We lowered the uric acid. We could block the high blood pressure. But we found that we were blocking other things like weight gain and insulin resistance. And that told me that the uric acid was a lot more important than just blood pressure. And then as we started studying, we learned that it was actually really key in how the biologic switch works. And then once we figured that out, then we said, okay, well, what other foods can drive the uric acid? And it turns out that a major type of food that does it are foods that are rich in purines. And so foods like beer, as you mentioned, it has a lot of brewer's yeast in it, which is turned into uric acid. So it isn't just the alcohol. Alcohol also generates uric acid. So drinking a lot of alcohol will raise uric acid, but brewer's yeast also does. So it turns out that of all the types of alcohol, You know, beer is very powerful at raising uric acid, and that's why there's a beer belly. That's why there's a, you know, beer raises blood pressure. That's why beer is associated with high fats in the blood, what we call triglycerides, and fatty liver. It turns out that a lot of that is from the from this pathway that involves uric acid. But it's also, purines are in some meats, like organ meats, especially liver, or it's present in certain types of gravies, and curing of foods can release some of these substances that can raise uric acid. And it turns out that there's a flavor called umami, and umami is one of the five taste buds, tastes that we have. So we have sweet taste, which is really there to help us pick out foods that like are rich in fructose. And we have this taste called umami, which helps us pick out savory foods. And it turns out that most of the foods that are savory are high purine foods. And they're probably, this whole taste is to identify foods that can help raise uric acid. So recently we did some studies where we could show that these, that umami foods can also cause obesity through this pathway. But before you panic, it turns out that we don't eat a lot of umami. So although it's often used to flavor foods, we actually don't eat a large amount of umami, like glutamate and things like that, which is in umami. And so although umami foods can trigger obesity and drive the same pathway, we're eating like 75 grams of sugar a day, but we're eating only like 2 to 3 grams of glutamate a day, which is part of this complex that of purines and glutamate that that stimulate the umami pathway. And that, and so we're not eating enough of that stuff to have a huge impact. But if you're drinking a lot of beer, it's sort of like drinking a lot of soft drinks. And if you're, you know, eating a ton of anchovies and shrimp and liver, you know, foods that are, quote, high in purines, you can theoretically get into trouble by activating this switch as well. But the big way to activate the switch is not so much through the umami pathway, but by eating a lot of foods that are either rich in sugar and processed foods like that, or have high glycemic carbs in which they're in making, turning into fructose in your body. So the big foods that are driving it are all primarily in the carb family. Mm-hmm. So things like high glycemic carbs and sugary foods, these are your primary mechanisms driving obesity. Mm-hmm. And the umami foods and the purine foods, they can play a role if you're like, you know, if you're eating fried shrimp every day, be careful, because that's going to catch up to you. But yeah, and alcohol, I mean, the heavy alcohol use can also activate this pathway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how far we have come from the 1980s when everybody was fat because of fat, and we removed all the fat out of food, replaced it with sugar, and replaced it with high fructose corn syrup, and now everybody's fatter than ever. It's just astonishing what we have learned about just how important sugar is in driving the obesity epidemic. Let's
talk about... Yeah, there's a nuance there, maybe just to bring out. And so if you put, so fat is sort of like a high energy food. So like 1 teaspoon of fat has more calories than a teaspoon of carbs. But in order to activate this switch, you have to, it's primarily from fructose, right? So if you're eating sugar and high glycemic carbs, then you're producing this fructose that activates the switch that makes you hungry. But if you once you've activated the switch, then if you eat high fat foods, you're going to get obese very quickly because you're eating so many calories and you've activated the switch that doesn't control your appetite. However, if you're on a low carb diet so that your switch is not activated, And now you're eating a high-fat diet, you're going to control your weight. So you're not going to be gaining this massive weight, even though you're on a high-fat diet. So the high-fat diet is sort of like firewood, and the fructose is sort of like the fire. You have to have a fire in order to become fat from the high-fat foods. So if you just ate a high-fat diet on a low-carb diet, you probably aren't going to gain much weight,
But if you have that pre-existing wood pile, as we call it in Chinese medicine, you then can ignite the wood pile. Because as I was, preparing for the show and looking at like, how do we lower uric acid? And a lot of it was everything you said, avoiding the sugary foods, avoiding alcohol, and really using some caution, around high purine foods. But another thing that came up over and over and over again is drink more water. And you talk about how dehydration is a major driver of obesity. How does dehydration play into the overall picture of metabolic illness?
Yeah, this turned out to be a really great surprise in our work. For years people have said drink a lot of water, and to help control weight. And there are a lot of people, yeah.
I've got my empty glass of water over here.
Exactly. I mean, so many people, run around with their water bottles, and a lot of physicians called it a myth that, you don't really need to drink a lot of water. The kidneys do the work for you, But it turns out that this isn't a myth. It's real. Drinking water is really beneficial. And the discovery of, our pathway to this discovery is kind of interesting. We remember we were studying this biologic switch, and animals become fat to help them survive winter and so forth. But remember, when a bear is hibernating, it's not drinking water. And the way it gets its water while it's hibernating is from the fat. And when the fat is burned, it produces water. And it turns out that animals in the desert store fat as a means to protect them from dehydration. And when they get really dehydrated, they break down the fat to generate water. The camel, for example, has a hump on its back that's fat, and it uses it to produce water when it needs it. So we were wondering, what could trigger, that fat is not just a source of energy, it's a source for water. So we were thinking that not severe dehydration, but mild, very mild dehydration might be a mechanism to activate this switch to help you store fat as a means to protect you. And one way animals can do this is by eating salt. So when you eat salt, you become thirsty. It's like creating dehydration without losing any water in your body. So, classically dehydration is you lose water because you're vomiting or diarrhea. But if you eat salt, you don't really lose water. You just become thirsty because the salt concentration goes up in your blood, and that makes you want to drink water to dilute that salt down. And it turns out that activates this polyol pathway, helps you convert glucose to fructose. So when you put salt on French fries, the salt is actually playing a role in helping you convert the potatoes to fructose, because the salt triggers this kind of feeling of dehydration that tells the animal, I need to make fat. So it starts producing fructose from the carbs to have you store fat. And so it turns out that salt, if you give salt to animals, it takes a while, it takes longer, but over time they become very fat. And salty foods work by the salt activates this enzymatic pathway that wants to make fructose. And so suddenly now the potatoes you're eating, a lot of the potatoes are being converted to fructose in your body because the salt is stimulating that. So when we started looking at this, we go, well, is there evidence that in people that this is the case. And it turns out that most people who are overweight aren't drinking very much water, and they're kind of like mildly dehydrated, and many of them are eating large amounts of salt. And you can show that they have in their blood signs of mild dehydration. They have a hormone called vasopressin that's circulating in their blood. And so they, most people who are overweight have evidence of dehydration, and they are, they've activated this pathway to make fructose. They're generating uric acid in their cells. You can show that that salt increases uric acid in the cell, for example. And so, and then the uric acid is triggering and helping trigger this switch. So it's kind of complicated, but basically what we discovered was that, you know, mild, very mild dehydration is a stimulus for fat, and things like salty foods are worse than unsalty foods. Like salted nuts are not recommended because the salt tries to make you convert the carb to fructose. So salted pretzels, the salt is actually helping to convert that pretzel into fructose in your body and to trigger the switch. So what's really cool about that, Lindsay, is that if you give water, you can prevent the salt concentration from going up in the blood, and you don't trigger the switch. So if you're drinking a lot of water, then even if you eat salty foods, you can block the switch from being activated. So we did this experiment where we took people and gave them salty soup. And you know, with soup, you know, like a creamy soup, you can add salt, and it's very hard to tell how much salt is in it. So we could make a soup that could raise the salt concentration in the blood just a little bit. And when it did it, it triggered the switch, and the blood pressure went up immediately in these people. And then to one group, we gave water with the soup. And we gave actually two different amounts of water. So we gave a lot of water, a little water, or no water. And basically what we found was that if the salt concentrations went up, they activated the switch, the vasopressin went up, you know, all these things. But if we gave them a lot of water, we could block it. And they, their blood pressure didn't go up, and they didn't activate the switch. And then in animals, we showed that we could even give high fructose corn syrup to animals, and they normally become very fat. But if we gave it with water, a lot more water, we could, even though they're eating the same amount of sugar and high fructose corn syrup, we could block the development of obesity. So it turns out that water is probably our easiest and one of our best ways to control weight. And the people who are drinking 6 to 8 glasses of water a day, or maybe even a little more, you know, that there's a science behind it. It's actually working by blocking this pathway. Now, you can drink too much water. So I don't want people listening to the show to start drinking liters and liters of water, because you can dilute your salt concentrations. So, you know, something like 6 to 8 or glasses of water a day is what I recommend. And you should get a benefit from that. So, you know, try it out. It's inexpensive. I'm not trying to sell anything.
Absolutely. I know I went through a weight loss journey last year. So in December of 2020, I was like, wow, this is the biggest I've ever been. And one of the things that I was very consistent with every single day was water. And it, you know, between water and intermittent fasting and exercise and sleeping and simply having a little bit more discipline with what you eat. And then I also didn't drink alcohol for over 4 months as I was doing this entire weight loss journey. All of that put together, the weight just naturally falls off.
Yeah, it's a fantastic, what you're just describing is actually a fantastic combination of things to do. Good sleep, intermittent fasting, reduction in carbs and bad foods. You know, especially not all carbs, just, you know, like the high glycemic carbs and the sweet foods, just trying to reduce it. All of these are just, it's just a spectacular approach to losing weight. And then one of the One of the things that our work also identified is that if you're overweight or obese for a long time, it's a little harder to just do what you just said and lose the weight, keep it off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because when you keep activating the switch, the way the switch works, it's working on the part of the cell that makes energy. And it turns out that we have these mitochondria in our cells that are pouring out the energy or ATP that allows us to do what we want. And the way the switch works is it reduces the amount of ATP produced from the mitochondria and in turn shifts the energy from this kind of instant energy into stored energy, which is fat. So you have a certain amount of energy coming in and instead of or calories coming in to become energy. And the way the switch works is it suppresses the mitochondria from making a lot of ATP, and instead the calories get shunted towards fat. It's a brilliant system, you know. Just we're going to reduce the amount of energy you use to do what you want. So it's going to slow your metabolism, and at the same time we're going to shift that energy to fat. And this way you're going to have more energy to survive on when there's no food around.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's the way the switch works, is it causes what we call oxidative stress to those energy factories. And normally, this is sort of it's sort of like hitting the mitochondria with a hammer. And you hit it lightly once, it recovers completely, But if you keep activating the switch and causing this oxidative stress to continually go on to the mitochondria, eventually the mitochondria start to get damaged and they become, they decrease in number and function. And so when you do intermittent fasting, all those things are good at stimulating the mitochondria to recover, stopping the sugar, reducing the sugar, doing all these things. And the mitochondria will regenerate and improve. But if they've been really damaged, it may be hard to bring them fully back. And so then what happens is a person won't gain any more weight. They won't go up in weight, but if they lose weight, they'll find that they still have to eat very small amounts of food or they'll gain weight back. Mm-hmm. It's like a trap. You can eat anything you want when you're 20. Now I got my weight down there, but I find that I can only eat a small amount of food before I started gaining weight. And they feel it's sort of like being locked in where the body wants you to be fatter than you want to be.
Yeah, this is taking me back to my pharmacy school research where we were analyzing. I was looking at different molecular entities and their what was called the defense of the metabolic set point. Once you are this weight, your brain's natural inclination is to stay that same heavy body weight, which is why so many people yo-yo diet, is because the brain's actually built that way.
But you can reverse that. And the way to reverse that is to improve the mitochondria. Mm-hmm. And the very best way to do that, intermittent fasting helps it.
Mm-hmm.
Low fructose diet will help it. We've proven it in people. So you can improve the mitochondria with all the things that you did. But the one thing that you haven't mentioned, but I bet you did, is exercise. And one of the beauty of exercise is not burning calories. Forget it. You don't burn enough calories to really have a big impact on weight. But from the calories, but the way that you have the big impact on weight from exercise is a long-term effect of exercise to improving your mitochondria, because it's the best way to help rejuvenate your mitochondria. Mm. And it requires, it's a particular type of exercise. It's what we call zone 2 exercise, where you're like on a stationary bike or a bicycle, or you're walking or you're jogging, but you want to raise your heart rate a little bit, but not so that you can, the best is that you can still converse while you're exercising. So if you can talk to someone, it may be a little bit hard to talk to someone, Because maybe hard because you know because of the degree of exercise, but that's where you want to be, where it's you can still maintain a conversation, but it's a little hard to talk. That's the level that you want to be at to stimulate those mitochondria. And I think that, you know, there's what damages the mitochondria, which is like chronic activation of the switch, and there's like how to recover the mitochondria if they've been chronically damaged, and that involves, you know, things like taking vitamin C helps, and exercise is a huge thing that can help. And then, you know, all the things you were mentioning. You exercised, didn't you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Last year, I called it my year of running, you know, because it was the first time in my life that I'd done a 5K, an 8K, a 10K, all the things. So, Dr. Richard Johnson, this time has flown by. I feel like we could have talked for another several hours. We may have to have you back for part two because we didn't even get to dementia. We didn't even get to what is now, you know, clearly being labeled as type 3 diabetes. It all is on one continuum. So listeners, please go pick up a copy of Nature Wants Us to Be Fat, and you can find more about Dr. Johnson and his work at www.drrichardjohnson.com. Thank you so very much for coming in today and being a guest on the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Thank you, Lindsay. It was great.
If you've been struggling to feel your best and feel like that food, sleep, relaxation, none of it is truly working, maybe you need to up your game with some infrared light and negative ion therapy. Infrared light penetrates deep into your body, going through your skin to muscles, nerves, and bones. Infrared light then helps to boost local circulation, bringing oxygen and anti-inflammatory molecules, as well as flushing away toxins. Therefore, infrared heat has been shown to reduce muscle pain, joint pain and stiffness, arthritic pain. It also helps to reduce stress and fatigue and supports the immune system. Negative ions act as attractors to bacteria and allergens in your environment, and they can help to inhibit free radical oxidation as well as reduce exposures to heavy metals, viruses, and other harmful elements, and can help to balance the body and the mind. The Amethyst Biomat is specifically designed to help provide infrared light as well as negative ions by electrically charging a mat full of amethyst crystals. It truly is an amazing experience to lay on a biomat. I have one as well as the tourmaline and amethyst pillow, and they have become part of my daily relaxation routine. If you want to get one of your very own amethyst biomats, head to lindsayelmore.com/biomat and you can be on your way to relaxation and less stress and fatigue throughout your day. Head to lindsayelmore.com/biomat to shop now. The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Derek Lugo. Sound design and editing is by Jive Media. Support The Lindsay Elmore Show by heading to lindsayelmore.com/podcast. Your contribution, no matter how big or how small, helps us to bring the best guests to the interview chair. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Share this and all of your favorite episodes with a friend and on social media. Be sure to tag at Lindsay Elmore Show and help us bring the pod to more people.